He wants these people to invest part of their Social Security into these securities.
Marianne, thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, we ran out of time.
Nope.
We threw around two phrases tonight, defined benefit and defined contribution. We talked about it in terms of the pension benefit guarantee. Jerry talked about it. And Republicans are very quickly trying to change a defined benefit program into a defined contribution program.
And our apologies to the caller holding on line two. We ran out of time. Please call back next week.
For Akhil, for Scooter, and for Glenn, I'm Leo Gold. It's been a pleasure being with you for another edition of the New Capital Show. I will be back 1 week from now, God willing. Good night.
To Houston. My name's Scooter. You're listening to Monday Night Radio.
I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist priest to teach the
office. Cause they never had this.
Number one, never want to run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one.
Democrats are good.
I'm the epitome of public enemy. Use the people.
Republicans are bad.
They even had it on the news.
Republicans are bad.
Don't believe the hype.
Democrats are good.
Yeah. Was the start of my last jam, so here it is again. Another death jam, but since I gave you all a little something that I knew
Democrats
you lacked,
they still
consider me a new jack. All the critics you can hang on my hold the rope, but they hope to the pulse and pray it ain't dope. The follow-up Farrakhan, he'll tell me that you understand.
Oh, man.
Until you hear the man. The book of
anyway.
The new school rap game. Writers treat me like Coltrane, insane. Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different kind.
Public enemy. Look, if you've been listening to this Monday Night slot here, Monday Night Radio here on KPFT Houston, my name's Scooter. You'll notice that we kind of been alternating between two programs, Takes on the World, Jeffrey Blankford's excellent show out of KZYX, which is Northern California, and Slave Revolt Radio. Slave Revolt Radio is out of Berkeley. So anyway, Jeffrey Blankford's... I don't know. This guy goes back so far, he won't even... he didn't even want to talk about it. He's a photographer, print and radio journalist from Northern California. This guy goes... this guy goes into the Middle East. He knows it like the back of his Robert Fisk. He's been a spokesman for Palestinian rights since before it was cool.
They drink Clorox, attack the black because I know they lack exact the cold facts.
On the other line, we got Gerald Smith. Gerald Smith from Slave Revolt Radio. Commentator. Union activist. Organizer. And an old school Oakland Black Panther. So let me put these guys on. Hold on.
I get on the mix late in the night. They know I'm living right, so here goes the mic sight. Before I let it go, don't rush my show. You try to reach and grab and get elbow. Word to hurt, yo, if you can't swing this, learn the words. You might sing this, just a little bit of the taste of the bass for you.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
How you doing? Jeffrey Blankford and Gerald Smith. What's up, guys?
Nothing much. How you doing,
Jeff? How you doing, Gerald?
All right.
It's a California night. How y'all doing?
I'm doing fine. It's raining up here. Cats and dogs.
All right.
Squirrels
cats and dogs.
And,
living together?
Yeah. Huh?
Nothing? Go.
Oh, go.
It's your show, dude.
It's interesting, the stories about the Palestinian election.
Yeah.
As if the election of Mohammed Abbas, the favorite candidate of Sharon and Bush, election is going to change anything, when in fact what happens in Israel and Palestine is more or less determined in Washington. Because the AIPAC, the Israeli, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the lobby, which has grown from a one-man office back in the 50s to a 165-member staff operation with $34 million budget, really now controls the Congress, and every real expert on the issue who has studied it has come to the conclusion, from Edward Said to Sheryl Rubenberg to Ian Bostick-Lustig to Juan Cole, that AIPAC essentially controls Congress, which in a sense controls what happens in the Middle East. So nothing's going to happen there that the lobby doesn't want to happen. And that's the sad part of the story.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
You know, here's where I kind of think that the American ruling class controls the Congress, but I know exactly what you're talking. I had no idea, to tell you the truth, until you just said it. 160 staff running a $34 million budget. That is absolutely enormous.
What's really critical is, like last year, the Washington Post reported they had 2,000 meetings with Congress people who they are constantly sending on trips over to Israel. As a matter of fact, during the hearing for Gonzalez the other day, they announced that Senator Kyle couldn't be there because he was on a special trip to Israel.
Wow.
Now, you know, these U.S. senators never go on these fact-finding trips to Mexico, which is a country that has much more to do with the United States
right.
in so many ways than does Israel, but there's no Mexican lobby per se, and so this is why you have these folks going to Israel. As a matter of fact, one of the most important ways that AIPAC works is by offering to Congress people an offer they can't refuse, is giving them interns, well-educated, very skilled young people who go into their office to work free.
Damn.
And no congressperson can deny the offer of a free, skilled political person. And actually, some of these people have gone on to become members of Congress themselves. And even some the head of AIPAC.
Man, now look, you know what? I still want to question whether or not they control the Congress.
Do they control the Congress?
Yeah, whether AIPAC control. But I do want to share this with people. We have a congressperson near Atlanta, McKinney. Is that right?
Cynthia McKinney.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I just want to remind the listeners what actually happened now, because I talked with her about this. And to the best of my understanding, Jeff, you correct me if I get the facts wrong. When they decided they wanted to get rid of her, they picked a very conservative Negro judge,
right.
was, to run opposed to her in the Democratic Party. But what it was, my understanding is, they had this open primary.
That's right.
And so Republicans were allowed to vote as to who would become the Democratic Party candidate.
That's right.
In an area that was predominantly Democrat.
That's right.
So what they did was, this was very similar to some of the counterintelligence program stuff they used against the Panthers. They started slandering her. For instance, she asked questions about 911. What they then said was that she was making accusations about the president. And that's not actually factually correct. That's not what happened. She asked, there's a difference between a question and an assertion. You know, and intelligence has long ago left mainstream American politics, and what you get is the sound bites and all the other little crap that they use instead of a serious argument. But people should be aware that that's what they did. And they ran this woman against her, and she was defeated.
But she came back.
Well,
sure,
you know,
she's back.
I was actually...
No, but Jeff, what I was going to say was, my understanding was, and I am. This is not an anti-Semitic argument. I do not hate Jews. Let me make that really clear. But I understand that the Jewish lobby was involved in this manipulation.
It was the way it was involved was very critical. It was involved the same way it was involved in Birmingham, Alabama, when they defeated the other black politician in Congress who was willing to criticize Israel, an old civil rights veteran named Earl Hilliard.
Yes.
What they did is they picked two people. They selected two people, Denise Majette, who was a judge in Atlanta, and Archer Davis, to run against Hilliard. And the press totally slandered them, and money from wealthy pro-Israel Jews from all around the country flowed into both of these campaigns. And in this case, there are 40,000 Republican crossovers helped to defeat McKinney. Now, I know, Cynthia, I was actually down in Atlanta for the last 12 days of her campaign this last summer. And because the Republicans had a campaign in their primary that they needed to vote for, they could not cross over, and Majette decided she wanted to run for an empty Senate seat. And that angered the Israel lobbyists so much that they demanded their money back. And they were public about it. That they had an investment in her, and she had won the congressional seat and decided to leave it, and they were furious. So Cynthia ran, and she had the goal of getting 50+1% of the vote, because the Zionist lobby was waiting to see who would be in the runoff with her. And so they didn't back anybody. There were four or five other candidates. They put two black women in there to garner votes away from Cynthia, but that didn't work. And she got 50+1, which left the lobby sitting in the starting blocks. It was an incredible, real people's victory. And actually, I was there for the celebration of the party, the victory party in July, which is essentially when she won back the seat in the Democratic area. And it's, I don't remember any time that I have been in a situation where I could actually celebrate a real measurable victory like I did that night in Atlanta.
But it's a funny kind of victory there, Jeff. Because while I certainly like to see the defeat of the Zionist lobby, I am for that 100%. I got to be honest with you, Jeff. I ain't for them Democrats, man.
Oh, no. Look, you may not be for them. I'm not either, and I haven't voted for a Democrat since I voted for Lyndon Johnson in 64 on the basis that he would not extend the war in Vietnam. I think I made a mistake. And I penalized myself for many years. I became an organizer, actually, in the Peace and Freedom Party in 68.
Okay.
But in Atlanta, it's reality is if you're African-American, you're going to be in the Democratic Party. There's no third-party room down there. And so if you're going to be radical, you can be radical for what you do. Now, within the Congressional Black Caucus, John Conyers used to be the head of a group of congresspeople who spoke out critically of Israel. One after another, they got knocked off. Mervyn Dimely from Southern California, Gus Savage from Illinois, and Crockett retired. Dellums would never open his mouth about it. He was totally cowed by the lobby.
Yes, he was.
Conyers is the last one, but even he realized that it's a risky business, and in recent years, although he's been very out front on this election situation, he has not been out front on the Palestinian situation like he was maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
But on a certain level, Jeff, you have to admit that, and I'm not supporting, because I don't support Democrats anyway, but there is a real problem here. You know? I mean, my goodness, when you have that type of operation against an American congressperson that they ran, and I guess, you know, one might call it legal or whatever, it doesn't matter, just because it's legal don't make it right. that you would have Republicans picking the Democratic Party candidate, that's something to worry about, man.
Look,
that's very real.
I
can understand how people would be concerned with that if that's their game. If they're into, you know, trying to be a, quote, electable, unquote.
If you look at the political parties as two professional baseball teams and the crowd goes to the stadium and cheers one or the other and says, hey, we won. And you know, it's like someone's working at a business for a long time, like at a restaurant. I had a friend of mine who was a waitress at a restaurant. And she came home one night and she said, well, we sold 120 dinners tonight. I said, we? People get caught up in this thing. The fact of the matter is, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, unlike real political parties in Europe, have no existence outside of the election year. So if you try and find any city you go into, try and find an office of the Democratic or Republican parties. They're like these Christmas tree lots or pumpkin lots. Lots that come around just at election time, and they open an office in an empty building that one of their wealthy donors has vacant. He takes it as a tax write-off. But right now, if you go into New York City, you go into San Francisco, you go into Atlanta, Georgia, Houston, Texas, try and find an actual office with a Democrat or Republican sitting in there saying that this is the office of the Democrat or Republican Party. They don't exist. It's one of the great hoaxes on the American people.
It wasn't always that way, because if you recall out here in California, in the Northern California, particularly in the Bay Area, we used to have, these Democrats were actually publicly active, you know? And they had a little caucus going on in different clubs. But I noticed that it looks like the Reagan years were rough on them, but they held tight. But once, with the ascendancy of Clinton, it looks like things started to really get atomized. And you no longer saw very much a grassroots effort for these Democrats.
Well, actually, in San Francisco, the Democrats are more to the left, let's say, than they are now, but it was like a little club. But when Moscone and Harvey Milk were killed and Feinstein became the mayor, that set in motion a whole, what do you call, Manhattanization and moved to the center. But in fact, the Democratic Party, it together all across the country, was moving to the center.
Right.
And in fact, the reason I believe that they did not contest the election in Florida in 2000, because if they had, and they had gone to the Supreme Court, not with the hanging Chad nonsense, but with the fact that 75,000 black voters had been disenfranchised, they might have actually won. Might have won. But that would have made them dependent, obliged to the black voters for the cap, for the presidency, and the Democratic Party has been trying to move away from that for a long, long time.
Well, actually, it's not just a long, long time. And I'm sorry to bring this bad news to our listeners, largely who are Democrats themselves. And I know.
Now, come on. Calm down now.
I'm not Democrats. Talking about you, Scooter. I'm talking about people listening to the program. Let's face it.
Hey, I have a friend of mine in the studio here. His name is Akil, and I think he wants to has a question for Gerald. He's talking about some book he just read.
Gerald. Okay. Hey, have you picked up Head Negro in Charge Syndrome by Norman Kelly?
No, Akil, I haven't seen that, man. Head Negro in Charge by Norman Kelly.
It's called the Head Negro in Charge Syndrome. And essentially what he says, and it was published maybe about 3 months ago, is that the intelligentsia of the Democratic Party, or in particular the black community, has let us down, you know, essentially, has hit a brick wall. They're not innovative. They don't contribute anything sustainable, no institutional type of thinking. And essentially, he points to the music industry, the entertainment industry, as models for us to use in politics. And so I talked to him a little bit more about that, and we're going to probably cover it a little later here during our fundraiser. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Essentially, he named names from Martin Luther King to Louis Farrakhan to Jesse Jackson to Al Sharpton, that they're all a part of the intelligentsia of leadership in the black community, but they don't contribute anything to us.
So, Gerald, you have to throw that thing down in front of Tracy and let him tear it up.
Yeah. Let's go over this, because I think this is worthwhile. Number one, when we talk about the intelligentsia, Negro or otherwise, what we're talking about is the organic intellectuals, the intellectuals in this society, the people that lead the society, that part of the society where people are interested in ideas,
mm-hmm.
people who write the books, the poets, the professors, these types. Historically, it is absolutely true that the black intelligentsia, see, has always been split. Now, let's get this too. It's never been like the black intelligentsia was one guy. But for the most part, the best elements in the black intelligentsia clearly and consciously and vocally and through their writing supported the struggle for black liberation. The best example would be, let's say, W.E.B. Du Bois. Okay?
Yeah, that's a hard act to follow. Hard act to follow.
Black historians like Green and, you know, we can just draw a whole list, and it becomes very clear that most of the best of the black intelligentsia did try to make a contribution. Now, what happens? In the 60s, the fight for equality, the fight for justice, becomes a struggle for simply formal, legal, what they call integration. Okay? And it wins. It is successful. And that is to say that Jim Crow is destroyed. All laws that state that black people can't drink out of a fountain or buy a home or etc. are now illegal. And if you can prove that that's going on, you have half a chance at actually getting a little something that approximates justice. At this point, the nature of the black community changes dramatically. Whereas, under segregation, I don't know, you know, you guys ain't there, maybe Jeff might remember, there used to be something called a railroad track. Black communities were so segregated that well-off blacks lived in the same black area
right.
as poor blacks sometimes, you see? And so there was a compactedness of the black community. Following the civil rights struggles of the 60s, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, this changed. Black people who had moderate means, moderate incomes, were able to move to suburban areas. And they did it. And thus, the material circumstances of the black intellectual changed fundamentally. And thus, your environment changes, so the quality of intellectual that we now
and
have.
And the consciousness changes.
Has changed. That's right.
Interesting, because what he draws a line from there is to our current head Negroes in charge, what he likes to call them, your Cornel West, your Reverend Michael Dyson, and a host of others that he outlines in his book that he believes took that same path that you mentioned, that they moved from the same neighborhoods into your Princeton neighborhoods, your Harvard neighborhoods, you know, the real elite academic centers. And so, again, his charge to them is that, you know, they're not contributing anything except to the philosophical and aesthetic value behind democracy and politics, but you know, nothing that, you know, your average common man and woman can use.
Well, they're talking among themselves.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that Gerald brought that up, because I grew up in Los Angeles. I spent a lot of time in Watson, around the West Adams area, before, while it was still relatively segregated. in which if you were black, no matter what kind of money you had, if you wanted to buy a home in Hollywood or if you're crazy Beverly Hills, you ran into all kinds of problems.
Right.
But once that happened, before that, there was like a really live community. And when those with the wherewithal, the economic wherewithal left, the majority still were segregated, but they didn't have that cultural input, mm-hmm. the input of a wholesale, whole community that you had before.
Yeah, you know, that whole thing of breaking down the walls of segregation and stuff, it really was a double-edged sword, you know.
That's right.
Because you know, I mean, like, you know, when people used to travel across the country, they, you know, you pull into Oklahoma City, well, you just, you know, you look around and say, well, where's the black part of town, you know? And the whole, now, there's these whole movements and programs trying to get black people to support black people, but it used to be that you had no choice, man.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You had to go to the black restaurant to eat because the white people weren't going to give you nothing, and you
right.
couldn't use the bathroom.
Right.
Anyway, let me interrupt you all for a minute because I want to give it the phone number. You all want to take some calls?
Yeah.
Okay. The phone number is 713-526-5738. This is KPFT. We're talking with Jeffrey Blankford. I got Akil in the studio. Tori Mercer's in the other room. And we got Gerald Smith from Slave Revolt Radio. And so give us a call, and we'll put you on the air. And if you have some questions for the panel, I don't know what we're talking about, but it's fun. Sounds like community radio. Community radio.
Watch yourself now.
Hey, we got a call. Hold on. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Hey, I'm enjoying the show. Great show. Great guest. I agree 100% with both Mr. Blankford and with Gerald. I live in Fort Bend County, which is just south of Houston, and the Democratic Party is a joke. I mean, they talk a good game, but they never really deal with the issues at hand. And this is my point. There are communities in Fort Bend County that are older than the cities that have grown up around them, called Freeman communities, where free slaves started living. And these communities still don't have street lights or sidewalks or anything else. So it doesn't matter if there was a Republican or a Democrat in office, these certain things never change. Another thing that's never changed is the way minorities are treated by the criminal justice system. They had a big deal with the HPD lab where they found out that hundreds of people have been sent to jail or prison for crimes they did not commit because of faulty lab work. And it's like, oh, well, sorry, next. And that, nobody's gone to jail. Nobody's been fired. You know, these are the issues that we need to deal with, and our so-called intelligentsia are not dealing with that. And I also would like to put out that since this is happening and the Democratic Party is moving away from the black base, what should we or can we do? And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
I have one comment. If you're waiting for the Democrats or even the left, you know, to stand up against the drug war, I mean, start holding your breath now. And by the end of my sentence, you'll be dead.
Oh, well, check this out. Let me deal with that because I want to thank the brother for his intervention. That was thoughtful, very thoughtful. But a couple of things we have to be worried about. Number one. We do not have a black liberation movement in America. There is not a single black organization, and I'm being specific now, NAACP, Nation of Islam, whatever, that actually has the allegiance or the loyalty of a sizable portion of the black community. For instance, when I was in the Panthers, I was surprised to find out, around 1970, somebody did a survey, and they found out that something like 70% of the black community supported the efforts of the NAACP, and 25% of the black community supported the Black Panther Party's efforts. I thought that was very interesting. But you see, today the NAACP is no longer a genuinely civil rights grassroots organization. It is what we call in the community now AstroTurf.
You know,
because the people don't give them no money. You go and check, where do they get their money from? They get it from corporations.
No, Gerald,
Can I interject something there?
Of course.
Okay. The NAACP has been was irrelevant during the Civil Rights Movement, other than Thurgood Marshall going to court. It had a lot of money, but it was totally irrelevant. In San Francisco in the early 60s, they had a dynamic leader, Nat Burbridge, who led sit-ins at Sheridan Palace and the Cadillac Agency, but that was the end of it. What happened is about 10 years ago, so Ben Chavis, the Reverend, became the head of the NAACP, and he decided to make it relevant, and
they
he started going to the youth.
They got rid of
it. And
him.
What happened is the people who fund the NAACP, and let me tell you, they're the same people who fund AIPAC, decided to attack him. And the Jewish National Weekly Forward, for about 15 straight weeks, ran front page articles attacking Ben Chavis. And why? Because he had supported the Palestinian liberation struggle. Commentary Magazine, the Bible, or the first Bible of the neocons, spent articles attacking Ben Chavis. And finally, Ben Chavis was forced to resign, because what happened is the donors, not from the black community, but from the basically the pro-Israel lobby, who were keeping the NAACP healthy financially, but politically dormant, they withdrew their money.
You got to stay away from the Palestinians
if
you're going to get anywhere.
Hold on one second, Jeff.
Jeff,
I love you. But Jeff, let's be careful now, because while I understand the importance of Israel, understand it was not just the Zionists who were against my man Ben Chavis.
Let me tell you.
No, no, hold on, Jeff. Hold on. Let me just throw something else out in the mix, all right? The NAACP gets big bucks from people like Ford, IBM, and I'm not trying to be to downplay the Jewish people, but I don't think they're owned by Jews.
Let me tell you.
No, hold on now. Yeah. So get this right.
Right.
When he said that he was going to unify the black community, and he wanted to, he called a meeting with Angela Davis, Stokely Carmichael, who was known at that time as Kwame Ture, I think, and other prominent black leaders that advocated black power, or sometimes in the case of Angela Davis, socialism. That's when they really went nuts. And they cooked up this scheme about him having sex with some lady. My goodness, is that against the law? And
it was actually
he's gone. Okay?
Yeah,
but I don't think, I'm not, I just want to broaden that out a bit.
Let me tell you, I really followed this very closely. From the very beginning that Chavis came in, and the main attacks against him were in the Forward newspaper, which was run by a former Wall Street Journal editor, vicious attacks. And when he finally, it wasn't having sex, he had given a job and a loan to a woman. Whether he had sex with her didn't come up.
Well, yeah,
but the thing
they
is,
tried to play
is
that
they,
up. Go ahead.
Is,
hey, gentlemen, let me, can we put a caller in the air?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, hold on. Line one, you're on the air.
Whatever you wish. Hello?
What's up? You're on the air with Jeffrey Blackford and Gerald Smith.
Gentlemen, good evening. How y'all doing?
Fine, thank you.
I want you to get your take on, I was trying to get it on the last program, about the Iraq situation. There is a Republican congressman today has publicly said we need to pull out of there. And I was reading a report the other day from the Iraqi resistance saying that they're willing to outlast us, and they say, come send them on over because we're going to continue to cut them up. And I would like to know, how much more? How many more troops do you think we're going to lose? We're already up to about 1,400 now.
Well, I can tell you one thing, that when the two ranking generals came over to see Bush before the mess hall bombing to tell him that the U.S. had essentially lost, the reason the two came over and not one was because Bush wouldn't have believed just one of them. But when the Americans troops, the mightiest army ever mobilized, cannot go on the highway to the airport. You know what the situation is. It's very, very difficult. Now they're talking about something called the El Salvador option, which they would set up kind of death squads like they did in El Salvador to pick off the leaders and members of the Iraqi
resistance. But the problem is that it's a very different situation. In Guatemala and El Salvador, they had armies that were already killing the people.
Correct.
And they don't have that in Iraq. And the
That's
problem
right.
that they don't realize is they're having a difficult time getting Iraqis to kill other Iraqis.
And there was an NBC News correspondent that was nearly killed himself today trying to report on an ambush.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They showed it on Countdown tonight. I mean, I think this is starting to unravel, and I want to get the other gentleman's opinion, the one on Slave Revolt Radio.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I think that, unfortunately, we make, live joke about this on Slave Revolt. We say, you know, our head coffin business is going to go up. And what we mean by that is the number of Americans that die in Iraq, unfortunately, is going to increase. It's going to continue. And you know that means the number of Iraqis are also going to die. So they don't see a way out, and they lack, I know it seems hard to imagine, but the way they're looking at it, they don't want to leave because they would lose faith. If they left, if they just said, okay, this isn't working, we must try something else, let's withdraw our troops,
they
feel that would be an insult to the empire.
Kennedy used to call that credibility.
That's exactly right.
That's right. Hey, look, thanks, caller. We got another call on the line. You guys ready?
Hope we answer.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yes. Okay, line two, you're on the air.
Hold up.
How you doing?
All right, Scooter. Congratulations, man. You get better and better with time.
I'm just sitting here letting these guys talk, man.
It's like fine wine.
Hey, listen, this is Brother Avery from Phoenix, originally from Phoenix, Arizona.
Cool. All right.
And I'm originally from the reservation of Harlem, New York City. But I listen to Slave Revolt Radio on the web. But one thing I have to say, one of the panelists here, Gerald and whatchamacallit, they forgot to mention the impact on Brother Malcolm during the 60s and the disconnect from the 60s with COINTELPRO between urban blacks and southern blacks in disarray after the so-called COINTELPRO, the disillusionment or the disimbursement of the Black Panther movement, and the disbursement of the Black nationalist movement. We saw three things collapse in the 70s that put the generation of Africans in the United States in disarray. And it never, never fully recovered. And you have the gap in leadership between the so-called civil rights establishment, mostly mainly from the South, and no urban counterpoint to that kind of leadership. The only thing that probably would resemble that is probably a Louis Farrakhan, but no other in urban cities, because when they were electing so-called black mayors, they were really electing Uncle Toms and black faces. We had Stinkin' Dinkins in New York. We had Uncle Tom Bradley in L.A. We had all kinds of mayors, but no real black leadership exploded in the urban centers where the majority of the black population is. And I wanted Brother Gerald to comment on that. And my last comment is that powerful people never teach the powerless how to take power from them. You have to take it from them in the language they understand. So I just want to hear Brother Gerald's comment on that.
Well, I mean, I think that your statement is fundamentally true. I would only want to add to that statement, brother, that besides the fact, and for our listeners, so that you don't just hear a code word, COINTELPRO, I am working on the case of Eddie Conway, who is a Black Panther Party leader, who is currently at Jessup Penitentiary in Maryland. He was the leader of the Baltimore branch of the Panthers. And here's where this COINTELPRO stuff plays in. Here's a guy that was accused of murder 33 or 34 years ago, absolutely innocent. There was no evidence that he had anything to do with it, no physical evidence, no witnesses. But he denounced the judge as racist. The judge was racist. But you do need a better legal strategy. I mean, looking back at it now, we're honest about our errors. But he's still in jail, an innocent man, okay? So COINTELPRO was the government's attempt to destroy the Panthers through dirty tricks,
by sending in informants, by trying to stir up problems between the Panthers themselves. And I'm sad to say to y'all that it worked.
The dope and the snitch jackets.
That happened, yeah. And this is the other thing that I wanted to add to what the brother said, and that is that many of the leaders of the civil rights and the Black Power movement were co-opted by the Democratic Party. That is, that added to the collapse of our mass organizations of the 60s. I hope I spoke to your point.
Well, the COINTELPRO, the message from COINTELPRO to those who came after was that you were going to either be killed, you were going to go into exile, or you were going to go into prison. So what happened? They retreated to the universities.
Well, actually, Jeffrey had a little bit. It wasn't COINTELPRO, but you did have somebody on your butt about 12 years ago, didn't you?
Well, you're right. I was helped to expose a nationwide spying operation by the Anti-Defamation League.
And it worked.
Huh?
That's the one that worked. Well, y'all actually proved it, right?
Yeah.
They lost the court.
The problem was, it still goes on, but they were keeping tabs on every political organization in the Bay Area, Northern California and Southern California, and they also had agents in Chicago and in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a nationwide operation. We helped to at least temporarily break it up in Northern California.
Well, it was exposed. That was a great success, as far as I was concerned. Right.
It was a great success.
Well, they found those guys in the police department.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
They did.
Jeffrey's not allowed to talk about this stuff. Jeffrey's not allowed to talk about this stuff because he settled out of court.
No, I am allowed.
Oh,
I would not settle with any kind of gag order. One of the things they keep far away from me these days because they know I'll bring out the South African Israel ADL connection, but their spy, their chief informant, considered for the whole nation, this guy Roy Bullock, was also working with South African intelligence, spying on South African exiles of the anti-apartheid movement. Had in fact trailed Chris Hani, who probably would have been president of South Africa when he came to California, and 10 days later, Hani was murdered in South Africa.
Hey, gentlemen.
I'd like to tell the listeners that we're really happy that all of this COINTELPRO stuff is over with.
What
the hell are you talking about?
But anyway, we got a caller on the line. You already? Line number 3, you're on the air. Hello.
Am I on?
You're on with Jeffrey Blankford and Gerald Smith.
Yes, this is David.
Hi, David.
I was in New York at the time when the whole thing about Benjamin.
Speak up, please.
Yes, I was in New York at the time when the whole thing about Benjamin Chavis was exploding on the scene. And, I mean, he gave an interview to Gil Noble, who hosts a program called Like It Is in New York. And he laid out, you know, all the things he had to go through, including when the ADL summoned him for a meeting. And they had documents showing everything they had on him. And he used that as a threat against him in case he did not, you know, pull out his appointment to NAACP. Also, if you get a text of a speech, the first speech Julian Bond gave to the ADL after he became president of NAACP, you understand how influential the whole APAC lobby is and extreme Zionism has on black politics today. So, I mean, the whole thing about it's easy to overstate, quote-unquote, the Jewish influence, but I don't think it's you overstating it when you talk about political Zionism and the effects it has on black politics. So I was in New York at the time. I read commentary. I read the Jewish Forward. And even Peter Noel of the Village Voice had a story on how the ADL manipulated the black politicians in New York to distance themselves and to, you know, oppose Benjamin Chavis as becoming head of the NAACP. So it is a fact.
And I'm glad you brought that up. And what happened is when after Chavis left, suddenly the NAACP had all their money back.
That's right.
That's true.
And they're out of debt.
That's true. But hold on. I'm still going to say, Jeff, I love you. I do not
disagree with you. You've got to investigate it.
But wait a minute. But I insist that a lot of what we're talking about here is not so much. See, I think the ruling class in America is not Jewish. I think the ruling class in America, in fact, is overwhelmingly anti-Semitic. Those bastards kept the Jews out of the country at their moment of need during World War II when they were being massacred in Europe. That's the American ruling class. They are anti-Semitic. And I think it's very that we should be careful because here's the problem, folks. Now, listeners, get this. When the Jews got here to the United States en masse after World War One and after World War Two, especially after World War Two, there was a very close relationship between the Jewish Americans and the Black Americans in the fight for civil rights.
Can I say something?
And that's what makes it so hurtful when the Jews were won over to Zionism and moved to the right, because they were really our allies here. They understood what we were up against in the South like no other group in America.
Can I say something,
Gerald,
please?
Can I say something, please? We see this rightward motion and now this Zionism becoming the ascendant tendency in the Jewish community.
Can I say something? The Jewish community
moving to the right, it is very hurtful. It is bad. We have to fight it. But I don't think that is the main thing. The Jews did not develop racism in America.
Can I say something, Gerald? Let's let the caller talk, and then Jeffrey.
Please, I just wanted to say that.
I'm sorry.
Caller, go ahead.
Gerald, there's a little bit of hysteria. You notice I never said anything about Jewish. I said political Zionism. The facts are the facts. I am one of the people that they spied on. I was one of the organizers of one of the largest anti-apartheid rallies in Central Park against the South African government.
Very good.
It was surprising to me that I was from the Caribbean. I was a student at NYU, and it was surprising to me that they were even spying on us, even though my connection was to one of the local unions helping organize the rally. So what I'm talking about, I'm not talking about Jewish people. I'm talking about political Zionism and the effects it having on Black politics today.
Well,
so don't bring the Jewish thing into it. You bringing it into it. Let me comment on this.
I want to ask the caller, where are you from?
I'm from the Caribbean, from the Windward Islands, Jamaica, Grenada, and St. Lucia.
Where at Jamaica?
Grenada and St. Lucia. My father's from Grenada, my mother's from St. Lucia.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, it's your turn.
Okay. After Chavis had to resign, Professor Gerald Horn of Santa Barbara was interviewed on KPFA on the morning show. And he alluded to an article in The Forward, but then he didn't bring it up again. I called him on the phone, and I said, why didn't you talk about the campaign of The Forward? He said, you know, if I had done that, the issue would suddenly become anti-Semitism. Gerald, that is a red herring. If you look at 25% of the Fortune 500 happens to be Jewish, it happens to be Zionist. 120 of the top 250 donors to both political parties in the 2000 elections happen to be Jewish. Now, the truth is not anti-Semitic and the truth is not racist. The fact of the matter is that the political power in America today, particularly in determining what's happening in the Middle East, and I have any number of Jewish professors, whether Sheryl Rubenberg, Seth Tillman, Steven Spiegel, they talk about this. And Edward Said, who was not talked about, Noam Chomsky is an exception. Noam Chomsky doesn't even mention AIPAC in any book he's ever written.
That's right.
But the point is to raise this issue of anti-Semitism or going back to the days when Jews and Blacks worked together, that's ancient history. And the fact of the matter is those were left-wing Jews, many of them communists, very radical, who were not supported by the mainstream of the Jewish community. I happen to come from that kind of a background, so I know it. Back in the 50s, when a group of Jewish doctors in Los Angeles protested the fact that the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital in Los Angeles, which was a Jewish-owned hospital, was racist against Blacks and Latinos, they protested, and what did the hospital do? They fired all the doctors from the staff. So there's an illusion that the whole Jewish community or the majority was on the side of the Black liberation struggle. It's simply not true. The predominantly white activists happened to be Jewish, but they were leftists, and they were not part of the mainstream Jewish community. So this is a history you have to understand.
I actually would agree with you.
Can I refer you to some...
Jeff, let me just say this one thing. I know from fact, from living and raised, being raised in, I'm a native New Yorker, man, and I know who hired me, and I know who didn't.
Who what?
Now, that may have only been a small section of the Jewish community. I can accept that, that the Jews are not one guy. I agree with that. No ethnic group, racial or otherwise, or nationality, is absolutely homogenous politically and in their attitudes towards people of other ethnic groups or races, etc. I understand
Gerald,
that.
Gerald.
You know what I mean? And you're right.
Gerald.
But I think
Gerald.
I just think it's important to note, though,
Gerald.
That the Jews did not... It was very different between the Jews and blacks in New York than the Jews and other European-derived white people.
One last thing, please.
In that city.
Gerald.
Good caller.
Gerald, are you familiar with the work of Gil Noble?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you write him, get his 800 number, and you could get... he did a three-part program on the whole thing about Benjamin Chavez, and get in contact with him, and he'll testify to what I just said, and that's all I wanted to say. So it's not about, like, quote-unquote Jewish people. It's about a particular strain or a particular group within the community, those who support the what I call extreme Zionism, who are causing such destruction in terms of black politics. And thank you.
And thank you, brother.
Yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
I'm like all kind of left out here, you know. I'm not Jewish or black or anything, man.
Me too.
Just some white boy.
But I do want to kind of bridge the generational gap here with Gerald and Jeffrey, and particularly Brother Avery, who definitely calls, you know, gives us listener support with some great ideas and conversation. But I think some of the questions that were left off was how do we bridge that those generational gaps? I think that you left off with points with the Black Power movement, and we know that that didn't really last, you know, longer than, you know, nationally speaking, more than 3-4 years.
That's,
you know,
right.
But what I had hoped to bring to Pacifica Stations is what we call in the culture of hip hop the fifth element of dropping knowledge and dropping science. So if you ever read up on the history of the culture of hip hop, that it started as birthed out of the Black Power and the Civil Rights Movement. And I like to get the experts their take looking forward in the future, if there are going to be any movements, whether or not they will involve the culture of those born in the hip-hop generation, which is effectively 1965 and on, and whether or not that will leverage itself basically into political power and not be marginalized as the other movements were, particularly civil rights and Black Power.
The time is ripe right now because, I mean, you got all these little white kids running around with the sneakers. I mean, I'm telling you, the black culture is just probably the strongest right now that it's going to get.
But
so,
that's a specific type of black culture. We're talking about a commercialized,
of course,
bastardized culture.
You're right.
Actually, you know, Akil,
yes,
I don't want to hurt your feelings, bro. But the hip-hop generation's a little younger than you are.
Hey, Gerald, the Beatles were different than the Beatles or the Stones. I mean, it's the same stuff.
You were born at least in the 80s.
Well, no, essentially, hip-hoppers, the oldest hip-hopper in the culture is turning 40 this year.
Okay, all right.
So what I'm addressing is that you're right. The maturation of the culture now has a very large segment in their 30s. So true that the larger percentage of the culture is 20, you know, 29 and younger, but we now have a controlling and mature adult segment that doesn't know anything but hip hop, but they're in their 30s and as old as 40 this year, 2005.
Okay, and
so what we find ourselves doing is strategizing and you know, discussing idealistically, you know, how do we become that next generation, or how do we move from the civil rights through the Black Power movement into what people call Generation X. I hate that term, but maybe it's because it hasn't been labeled.
Dude, that was like 20 years ago.
Well, that's right.
Let me 20
years ago, those guys were teenagers, and now they're 30 years old.
What did you say, Gerald?
No, Nikhil, let me try to deal with this from my own life experience. Here's what I saw. Right around 1972, 73, in New York, I used to be a DJ, you know? And I noticed, you know, people started playing those B-sides that was just instrumental and kind of just rapping to it and stuff like that. Then you got that song, Rapper's Delight. That was the bam. That exploded on the scene. And people started actually developing, really Sylvia and them over in New Jersey, started developing hip-hop as we know it now. And it started off as a very, kind of more like a dance party-oriented type of deal. And then you got Flash and the Furious Five and Kool Moe Dee and his crew and, you know, L.A. Sunshine and all of the cats. And then she developed a whole, like a little tiny little hip-hop Motown over there in New Jersey, you know? Sugar Hill Records or whatever they was calling themselves. Now, then what I noticed, and this was when it started getting interesting, as hip-hop became popular in the black community, young people started developing, getting their own drum machines, getting their own equipment, and you had like a thousand flowers blooming all over the United States, young people experimenting in their garages or wherever and just making up some music. Then, at that point, they had not decided to accept hip-hop. It was kind of questionable. They wanted to marginalize it. But as it became more and more popular and could no longer be ignored, at that point, that's when, I don't want to use the word, but the
co-op,
the N-A-G-G-I's for, you know, like Ice Cube and them,
right,
came on with that gangster rap. And the corporations embraced it, not the community. The community was enjoying the eclectic hip-hop intellectual over here,
right,
like KRS-One. Then they liked the guy over here, the Prince of Bel-Air. They liked his little form of rap. Everybody had a different little style, and that was fine. But that gangster rap became ascendant when the corporations saw that that's what they wanted to impose on the community and on America as what black music was about. And that was not a good thing for us. It's not over at all.
Right.
Because now that it's the main cultural form, you see, and now they done beat us down so bad to where, I mean, a kid can't even drive a car in Oakland.
Right.
They're going to stop your ass, and if anything is wrong, they're taking your car, and that's right, the end of that.
Yeah, but you never could, though. You never could drive a damn car in Oakland. I mean, I live in Oakland.
No, but it's not. I've never seen it like it is, like it was in the last couple of years.
Oh, man.
Really
Back when those rednecks were running
the... on your stuff, it's gone. They're taking your stuff from you, and that's it. And that's why all the kids are riding bikes around here now.
Because they're easily identifiable. And that's what
right.
I'm saying with the
exactly,
culture. You're able to identify them, you know, much easier now because they've incorporated, you know, style, dress. You know, again, all those corporate things are cultural things that you need. And the next step, I think, is the political power that we're hoping
to work
for.
Well, they tried. You got to understand, they really made an effort to go out there and support Kerry. I'm talking about black hip-hoppers.
Carry on.
They made a real effort to get out there, and I can tell you it's not over. It is not over. The book has not been written on the effect of hip-hop and what's going to happen because the economics is getting so bad. You can't find a job nowhere, and everybody can't be a rapper. So let's see, because as we begin to see a response in the black community to deal with the economic problems, the other environmental problems, hip-hop will have a chance to play a role. And, well, we're going to have to let history judge that.
Thank you.
Hey, we've been talking to Jeffrey Blankfort.
Yes, thank
Gerald
you.
Gerald Smith, the California crew.
California
right.
crew.
Thank you, gentlemen.
All right.
And you can tune in to hear either one of these gentlemen every other week right here on KPFT Houston.
Definitely.
All right.
Kill, Tori Mercer, Gerald Smith. Jeffrey Blank.
Take care.
Later, later on, Akil.
Later. All right,
man. I'll see y'all, folks.
Right.
See ya.
I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist, preach to teach the all. Cause they never had this. Number one, they wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on